we are back with episode 810 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and let's bring this week on home.
That's right, yes. We are going to be going over yet another week's of episodic discussion, this time the episodes that ended on the 23rd of May, or the week ending the 23rd of May. So, yeah, there were some big shows that came in around this time, so we had a lot to talk about. Before we do any of that, though, Gary, I believe that there is a disclaimer that you need to give.
Yes. While we are closer than the last episode, we've still given you more than a week's time to watch these episodes that we're talking about. So we hope you've caught up and can either agree with us or disagree, and maybe even send us email or a voicemail or however you'd like to contact us to let us know if we're on the right track or did we totally screw up what this episode was about. So give us a listen. Tell us if thumbs up or thumbs down if you get a chance, or you could just nod in approval if necessary. But we will be talking about every aspect of the shows today, and we will spoil whatever needs to be spoiled to have our discussion.
That's right. Yes, so let's jump right into this. We had 19 shows on the list, 21 episodes, though, because there were a couple that were double episodes. And yes, of those, we only really got to see 17 out of the 19 shows collectively. So that is as it goes sometimes. We're going to jump right into the bottom three. This week we had shows that ranged from a dead average 7 up to a 9. The first one on the list here came in at a 7.5, and that is The Flash, Season 3, Episode 23, Finish Line. With nothing left to lose, Barry takes on Savitar as Season 3 ends. And wow, we had a big difference of opinion here on this episode.
Oh yeah, John. I'm rolling up my sleeves right now, John. Let's get started.
Go right ahead. Well, Henry came in at a dead average 7. As did I. Henry says, all of my notes for the first half of this episode is basically thinking, what the frack? I mean, the storyline and time travel mechanics are that confusing. I agreed, and one of the things that came to mind is, why didn't Savitar disappear immediately after Iris was saved? It didn't really make sense, and then there was the ending. I still don't understand what the heck was going on with Barry and his mom. Well, Gary, you completely disagreed with both Henry and I and gave this an 8.5. Yeah, so what did we miss? From your point of view,
Let's see. HR sacrifice. Iris did survive despite all the preparation and research and everything Barry did to work with Snark to try and get that get the device to shoot. All is worrying. All is nothing. It all amounted to nothing. Yet she was saved. Due to HR sacrifice. I thought that was sort of nice. That, I guess you know. Sometimes I feel Barry so much focuses on himself, and not in a selfish way, but I have to help. I have to do this. There's no one else that can. It's got to be me. And this, you know, this shows that it doesn't, that Team Flash does work, and that maybe if he had put more faith in them, other things might have been able to be avoided. And they weren't. And that's almost a sin of pride for him because, you know, he thought he was it and he wasn't. So so from that aspect, I found it very interesting and possibly even humbling to Barry that he was not the person that was able to save Iris. And he never thought otherwise. So at least that's in my opinion. So that was nice. The scene where he's seeing his mother again was interesting. This whole change in the Speed Force from this malevolent entity that's trapping speedsters in the Speed Force to sending out these black flashes to catch rogue time ones. Over to this sort of loving and, oh no, it won't be a torture chamber for him. And they're walking back hand in hand and, you know, very much of a different change. And maybe I want to think that maybe it's the speedster that's in the Speed Force that is shaping it and giving it its reason. Maybe Savitar being trapped in there was the one that sort of poisoned it and made it feel evil. Where with Jay being in it for a while and now Barry going, it's going to be much more of a much less of a malevolent force than it had been. At least that's was what I was kicking. I was kicking around, and okay. And then to see see everyone so happy about Iris came back really touched me a lot. I thought it was nice that despite all the she's going to die, she didn't, and so I was happy that they didn't. I honestly expected them to kill her. I didn't expect her to live at all. So it was definitely a twist ending for me. Were you surprised that she lived?
I was, and I was also surprised by the fact that HR was the one who did it, that kind of sacrificed himself. Maybe that was part of the reason I didn't like it.
I know. We like HR.
HR kind of grew on me, to be honest, and yeah, it was kind of disappointing for that to happen. But, yeah, I guess it just... it felt really kind of like they contrived a reason why this was such a big deal. When they once they avoided Iris dying, that should have been it. That was the whole thing that created Sevatar, from what they were saying. And it, all it did was reinforce for me some of the things that this season has, in my mind, just botched. I really feel like this was the weakest season that they've had, by far. And this just felt like, wow, yeah, this is the ending that this season really kind of earned itself. And I think that, yeah, just it's a full half point below where it was last year from our scoring. So I think across the board, we've really had a lot more criticism of The Flash this season. And like I said, I feel like this was all too in keeping with that. So I'm looking forward to them maybe stepping up to the plate a little bit more and better in the fourth season.
Well, I definitely felt that Sevatar was a weak villain as villains go. He, well, definitely the threat of Iris's death, he's almost stunk up the place because it was such an overwhelming weight that it was hard to go elsewhere. Or even, you know, when Barry lost his memory, that was probably about the only time we sort of had a lot of lightness in a while in the show. That, you know, combined that with Caitlin leaving, and you know, there was, you know, definitely wasn't an upbeat season, and maybe that's sort of what we need too. We need a little bit slightly less depressing Flash. Now I realize a lot of people love to see Barry wallow, and geez, it's been several seasons. Could we give this guy, you know, like six episodes off?
You know, yeah, I don't mind him having to have angst. I mean, certainly I like to, you know, myself, I tend to like characters to struggle. But The Flash was never entirely about that. It had shades of it. It wasn't dominating it. And I think that's what this season kind of did, is that it went too far into Arrow territory. And it did it badly.
It did get dark, that's true.
Yeah, and it didn't. It felt like it was trying too hard, and the fact that it's just going back to the same well over and over again. They really need to change things up. And who was really shocked by the revelation of who the Speedster was? Nobody was. So, let's see here. Next on the list, we have Designated Survivor, Season 1, Episode 21, Brace for Impact. Hannah Wells must stop the conspiracy from carrying out a final attack while President Kirkman authorizes a nationwide manhunt for the mastermind behind it all. This came in at an average 7. Much of the conspiracy plot relies on the good guys being incredibly dumb, thus allowing the bad guys to be a continuing threat. While Sutherland, in my opinion, just can't deliver the kind of speech that the writers want him to give, they're trying to make him this big inspirational leader, and it just comes off cross a bit ham-fisted, so doesn't work for me. Unfortunately, down at the very bottom yet again, we have Prison Break, Season 5, Episode 8, Progeny. When Sarah and her son's safety is threatened, Michael and Lincoln recruit the help of Sheba and C-Note to try and catch Poseidon. And yeah, a lot is happening, but this is the penultimate episode, and there was so little proper setup earlier that a lot of these revelations about who's the son of this person or that person, and that's what a lot of this episode was, because it is called Progeny after all. It just it comes across flat because they spent 7 episodes and not once did they hint that some of these characters were related. So, yeah. Didn't really work for me. So, unfortunately, those are those episodes at the bottom of the list. We have, however, some very good episodes at the top of the list, and coming in at our number 3 slot is American Gods, Season 1, Episode 4, Get Gone. Jumping between the past and present, Lara's life is explored, revealing how she met Shadow, how she died, and how she came to be sitting on the edge of his motel room bed. Yes. This came in at an average of 8.5. Nadim giving it a 9, saying a surprisingly touching episode with sharp character insight. Edmund giving it an 8, disagreeing somewhat, saying a TV detour into Lara's backstory, which could have been much more interesting if they'd actually shown some of the heist she dangled in front of Shadow. It makes her less of a cipher than in the book, but also less sympathetic. Robbie's wife hits the nail on the head with, "No wonder you call him puppy." Yeah. I give it an 8.5, saying that it wasn't quite as solid as the first 3 episodes were, because it's really difficult for me, at least in this episode, to relate to Lara's personality, or why Shadow would be so devoted to her. But to be honest with you, in the novel, Lara was the character I had the hardest time with anyway. She's Shadow's wife, she's like this thing that he is fixated on the entire time, but she really treats him like dirt when she's alive. And it doesn't really matter to me that she kind of starts to recognize that and try to fix it. she's just not very sympathetic at all for me. And she's played by an actress that I really like. So it's like, wow, you're making me hate this person. So, yeah, it's a little bit difficult. This episode is the first one where I feel like it didn't quite hit the note that I was hoping that it would, which is unfortunate. But there we are. It happens. Coming in at number two, and I'm surprised that this is the number two show, but it did get edged out a little bit. It is Twin Peaks, Season 3, Episodes 1 and 2, The Return, Part 1 and 2. My log has a message for you. The stars turn, and time presents itself. Yes, this came in at an average of 8.63. Rob Roberts over at VogNetwork.com gave it an 9.5, saying, so happy to have this back on television, even if I was a little unprepared for how R-rated this was going to be, considering the original was on network television, though it admittedly pushed the envelope there. Don't want to say much more specific, as I've watched the first four episodes now, thanks to Digital Showtime, but definitely feels like one big work and not so much episodic. But can we talk about the amazing closing credits song that was so reminiscent of Julie Cruz? Oh, absolutely. That song was awesome, yeah. And I already downloaded it. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the music that they use on this show, and they are continuing to go just really add some nice things to it. Edmund gave it an 8, saying, obviously more later Lynch than the Lynch of the original run. Weird and uncompromising, with even fewer narrative hooks than the recent work like Mulholland Drive. I'll definitely keep checking in, but I'm not feeling compelled to at this point. And that kind of puts a finger on something that I was really interested in hearing from fans, because I know that I was a huge fan of the original show, and the minute that I started watching this, I said to myself, this is much more like the movie. And not only that, but it's a lot more like, as Edmund says here, his more recent work, which is more obtuse than Fire Walk With Me ever was. And Fire Walk With Me was steps beyond the TV series. The TV series, this and the TV series, almost you could feel like they weren't even in the same universe, except they very clearly are. Because as we know from these first two parts, it picks right up where the other left off. So it very directly addresses the cliffhanger at the end of season two 25 years ago. So it's definitely Twin Peaks, but it's a more mature and surreal and obtuse version of Twin Peaks. I think that it was interesting that they found a way to come back without it feeling derivative or overly nostalgic or compromising. But at the same time, I feel like that could be its most difficult hurdle for people to overcome watching it. I know that we had a great time here watching it. I've seen both of these episodes twice now. I am reviewing this for VogNetwork.com, so go over there and read what I have to say there. I'll probably get more and more spoilerific as time goes on, but I definitely wanted to play with the impressions of it. But Gary, you gave it an 8, much as Edmund did. I mean, that's still an above-average score, but your thoughts on the beginning of this?
Well, yeah, I was a big fan of the original, too. Heck, I still have my picture of Dead Laura Palmer, my poster of Dead Laura Palmer. And I wanted to like it more than I actually did. I really feel this sense like he's trying to be esoteric just to be esoteric and not for the purpose of the film. That, you know, much like someone would choose to shoot in black and white instead of color, he's choosing to, go way out there in his depiction of this. And, as you talked about, being a little bit more like the movie, but this feels even, more sort of further out than that. And I watched it twice myself because, honestly, I said, oh, I watched it the first time. I was casually watching it. I must have missed things. I must have not caught something. So I watched it the second time, and there were a few little odds and ends that I did pick up on. But in general, I feel like he's trying to be obtuse just to be obtuse and not necessarily to push the story forward. Hmm. So at this point, I've only seen the first two episodes. I haven't watched any further. So I'll hesitantly revise my judgment. But, I mean, I understand if this is the format he wishes to present, and I don't have a problem with that, and it's unique in its own way, and you can get different things out of it because of the way he's choosing to present it. But at the same time, if you're just smashing a mirror to smash a mirror and not to some deeper meaning or something like that, it loses something for me. And some of the stuff, I think it's almost done. I'll use the term shock value, and I don't want to, but at least that's what some of this feels like to me. He's sort of being intentionally obtuse for no other reason than to, oh, look, it's avant-garde.
Well, one thing I will say is that it definitely, if you've seen a lot of his stuff, you know how we always say that, like, if you watch a lot of things that say Joseph Straczynski,
yes, right,
you start seeing similar notes being hit.
Yes.
Even dialogue.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, I know that, yeah.
This is definitely the way that I feel about this and David Lynch in general, is that I feel like his tics and his little quirky things that are uniquely David Lynch, because it's like you see it or you hear it and you know that's David Lynch. It's that amped up to the max for this. And that's both a draw, and I'm sure for some people it is a, as I said, a huge hurdle to get over, because they basically threw money at him and said, do Twin Peaks the way you always wanted to without any interference. And this is not a collaborative effort with other writers, other directors, other voices. This is David Lynch and his one writing, co-writing friend, Mark Frost.
Yes.
They wrote every episode and he directed the entire thing. And it's not even episodic. That's the one thing, like Rob said in his comment, and I completely agree with. This is one total, basically it is an 18-hour movie that has been chopped up into parts. And that's why it's not, separate episode titles or anything. It's part one, part two, and so on. And I think that is the biggest challenge of this, is that what we're watching is all pieces being put on the board. It's a lot of setup, but it's not setup that's done in a way that is giving you a sense of payoff at the end of the first hour or the second hour. This is the opposite of what we've said with Netflix. Honestly, it's Netflix is something that is written and kind of, it's dumped out there to be binge watched in 13 hours or whatever you want to call it. And it's built that way. It's built to be seen and binge watched. This is something that was made basically to be an 18-hour binge watch, and they're putting it out in parts. And I feel like we're going to get halfway through this, or not even halfway through this, and feel like, man, they should have just put this all out. They should have put this all out and let us just have one or two, because I'm sure some people would need to take a break, just one big, just, here's the last statement on Twin Peaks, pure David Lynch, main lines to your brain, and let it unspool that way. Because I feel like there's going to be hours along the way here that's going to be really tough to talk about. I'm going to do it, but I know it's going to be tough. Just by the first 2 hours here, and I have seen all four of the episodes that are available, and I stand by what I'm saying. There's also the reason that I bring this up is that there is a pacing to this that is very obviously meant to be seen as just one big work. Because if it was an episode and you were watching it and they spent 20 minutes going over something in very slow, methodical detail, it wouldn't work. But when you feel that it's just part of a very long movie, you kind of get the point. Or at least you see why it's so extended. The other thing that I would say here, even though I gave it a high score, I will agree with the people that said this did not give you, like, it started with a bunch of scenes that kind of called back to the original characters. In the first, I'd say half of the first episode, you got reunited to a lot of characters.
Yes.
And then they disappeared. Because most of the rest of the, basically the first half of the first episode has a lot of familiar characters to it. And then after that, it focuses a lot on Cooper's doppelganger, mm-hmm, and Cooper in the Black Lodge. So much so that if you are not up on all the details from the first two seasons and the movie, and I mean up, like, recently having reminded yourself of these details,
yep,
you will be lost. Completely lost. Bronstum asked on Facebook after I watched it, and I said, yeah, this is a great Twin Peaks. And he's like, oh, is it at all new viewer friendly? I couldn't tell him no fast enough. This is the absolute opposite of new viewer friendly.
Oh yeah, you're not getting new people to watch this.
No, not at all. And I'm sure Showtime is well aware of this fact. The ratings weren't great, as one would expect. I don't know how anyone could have expected the ratings to be off the charts for this. This was always going to be a cult show. Showtime knew exactly what they were getting themselves into. But the fact is that, yeah, I know some people who were devoted fans of the show that were kind of like, what did I just watch? There are a lot of people that think that this is exactly the way it should be because this is, you know, David Lynch just showing us exactly what he wanted to do to finish out Twin Peaks. I will say, this is, as much as people are like, oh, is there going to be a season four? No. Absolutely not. He said already, this is the final statement on the franchise. Which is fine, because I think that, no, let's go ahead and let him do his thing. As esoteric and weird and bizarre as it's going to be. And let's just kind of appreciate it for what it is. I liked it a lot. I think Kyle MacLachlan's performance is really quite amazing. I really was amazed at how some of the characters came back and were so dead on. I really liked the Log Lady's appearance. I don't know about you, but the one time when Hawk basically said goodbye... That felt like the actors saying goodbye to each other.
Yes.
And that was really hard to watch. But yeah, as a start, I think it's a really strong start for at least making the statement of what this new show or new incarnation is going to be. But I do agree with Edmund and with you, Gary, that this could be just too Lynch for its own good for casual viewers of the original show. There are going to be a lot of people that come back and say, oh, hey, this is just more of that, and they're not going to know what they're looking at. Because if you watched the second season of the show and then you went right into this...
Holy hell.
Yeah, completely. That's where I feel like you almost have to go from the second season into the film and then go to this, because it is like a... It's like a... at least a bridge. Because the movie was not what people expected either, but the movie was much closer to his film work at the time. This definitely feels like this is Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire. This is more film David Lynch. That said, I'll just give a little bit of a tease. Episodes 3 and 4 are available online. Having watched those, it's after the beginning of the third episode, it settles into more familiar territory. Slightly more familiar. But the tone is being set here in the first two episodes. Yes, this is a much more out there type of thing. Basically, yeah, could you imagine him doing that right from the beginning? No, but I will say this, though. If you watch the pilot and then you watch where this has evolved to, yeah, it's the same universe. There's no denying that. It's just definitely getting into weirder parts of it. Much weirder. The beginning of the third episode is going to challenge a lot of people. I'll say that much. But that's just kind of whetting the appetite for next week's discussion.
I hear you. And it's like, well, yeah, you wanted him, you get him.
Yeah.
There you go. You know, as I think about it, you know, I think people kind of forget how out there Twin Peaks was, as you hear different things described as Twin Peaks-esque, like Wayward Pines or something like that. I don't think you only have a casual memory of some of his oddities and unique filming structure, angles, and, you know, ways he chooses to use dialogue or not use dialogue. And, you know, this definitely sort of brought it back because, oh yeah, you're getting it in spades this time. So it's quite a refresher in some cases for me. I mean, I've watched his stuff. I don't consider myself to be an aficionado or anything of that, just that I've seen it and I usually enjoy it. And, but yeah, this, you know, my remembrances of what David Lynch is as a style maker was, had definitely watered itself down over the years. This definitely brought it back. And while this might definitely be a little bit to the extreme, I don't think I remembered the level of his work, and I didn't rewatch anything recently. So perhaps I had to sort of have my eyes opened again from all these quasi Lynchian projects to actually seeing his work again.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
This is, he came out of the gate with these two episodes swinging hard. He could have eased into it, but I think that part of the intent, it was to be so challenging and in your face, because Cooper himself to a degree is going through this process, And I think that it's trying to put you in that mind space. And it does it far better than perhaps it should. That said, I will also say that while the beginning of the third episode is really definitely amping this up even a little bit more, it then goes into territory in the rest of the third and fourth episode that I won't lie, we were laughing hysterically. So after watching the first two episodes, to think that it goes into broadly comic territory to the point where we've been quoting lines for like days now. It does go right into that kind of thing. So as I said, it's a hard start, but then it is going to, at least from the perspective of the next two episodes, it does become more recognizable. I think that's intentional, and it's just part of where he's playing more with the mental and psychological space than he might have done originally in the show. But as you said, if you go back and you think about what Twin Peaks was in 1990 to the viewing audience, and you translate that to 2017, the audience has gotten used to the level of challenging, weird, material that Twin Peaks represented back then. This now is almost, to a certain degree, doing the same thing that Twin Peaks did back then. I've noticed some people have said that, they were used to shows like, American Gods and The Leftovers and all these other shows that have really kind of been, that next level type of show. And even people saying, Better Call Saul and some of these other shows, The Americans and so on. And then they go and they say, I watched Twin Peaks and then I tried to watch one of those shows again. And it was like, wow, this is so much more normal than I thought it was.
Yes, now that I watched this.
And it's like, yeah, that's exactly the effect that the original had. That you would watch one of those episodes, and even some of the lesser episodes in season two, you would still come away thinking to yourself, there is nothing else like this on TV. And sure enough, I feel like this show, the only show that I really feel like touches on some of the same mental space for me recently is Legion. And yet I still feel like Legion was, I would say Legion is pretty original in its own right, but I feel like, as you said, Gary, we see all these shows that people say are Lynchian or like Twin Peaks, like Wayward Pines, and now we see why they feel derivative.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Because this is the pure, pure stuff.
It's like they grab 5% and they're wearing it like a crown of honor, and here we are putting the whole robe on now, and it's like, da-da.
Uh-huh. Yeah. This is definitely him at all, So for good and ill, I know there are a lot of people, and I completely understand Edmund's point of view, where it's like, I don't know that this is what I'm looking for right now. And it's like, yeah, maybe not. I could definitely some people. But then I also people out there, myself, Rob, and others that are sitting back and saying, you know what? This is the ride he wants to take us on. And I want to see how it ends. I've been waiting 25 freaking years. Show me how you want to end this, buddy. But anyway, that was actually the number two show for the week. Because The 100, Season 4, Episode 12, The Chosen, edged it out with a 9. And that's probably because there was only one score for that versus several scores for Twin Peaks that kind of ran the gamut. But anyway, The 100, it was a really strong episode. It was the penultimate episode. I really like the fact that the writers aren't having the characters just find some miracle to get over the fact that the world is ending. They actually are having to put a lot of time and effort into figuring out how they're going to manage the end of the world. And The Chosen refers to the people who are chosen to survive. So this episode is full of impossible choices that just have to be made, and the characters really go through the ringer, and it's a pretty compelling episode. It's one of the best of the season. So it's a little bit weird to think that Twin Peaks didn't wind up at the number one slot just because of the sheer talkability and discussability of the show. But, that is just the way that sometimes the scores run out. And that really is actually emblematic of why I feel like scoring the episodes is almost starting to run its course. The show to talk about this week was Twin Peaks. That's just the way it falls. We are running a little bit long on this one, so I think I'm just going to do the rundown and we'll capture stuff as we go.
Sure.
Better Call Saul, Season 3, Episode 7, Expenses, came in at an 8.5 from Edmund. Supernatural, Season 12, Episodes 22 and 23, Who We Are and All Along the Watchtower, came in at an 8.5. The Leftovers, Season 3, Episode 6, Certified, came in at an 8.5. I'll just read off Edmund's comment here. Closure for Laurie as she finally comes clean to Kevin. Interesting contrast between her loss and Nora's, with hers revolving around potentials and what ifs. And now she still has one secret to keep from Kevin. Oh, Nora, what are you doing? In the end, she's unable to keep either of her husbands with their loss, or unable to help either of her husbands with their losses, and that final failure for a therapist is too much. Sad but beautifully played, as we've come to expect. And yes, it's really difficult to watch an episode where the character in question effectively commits suicide at the end. But this is The Leftovers. That's somehow uplifting. Doctor Who, season or series 10, episode 6, Extremis, came in at an 8.25. Edmund here says, the Doctor edges into Da Vinci Code territory in ways that I found much more satisfying than anything from Dan Brown. And this is a Moffat puzzle box much more entertaining than the Sherlock fiasco. Yet it still came in at 8.25, which is not too bad. Arrow, season 5, episode 22, Missing, came in at an 8. Gary, you like this one a little less than I did, but any particular comments on this one?
I liked seeing Ms. Lance back again.
Black Siren is a
sorry. Yes. So that was nice. They had promised that she would be coming back, and I was sort of scratching my head. And your alter ego also appeared, yes, which was a very pleasant surprise. I honestly never expected to.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, it was a surprise when I mean, admittedly they showed him in the previews, but I was still like, how the hell are they going to pull that off?
Especially given the fact that Steve Amell, for all that I feel like he's a really stand-up guy, his public feud with Manu Bennett was the kind of thing that you feel like they would never be able to overcome, and so for them to put aside their questionable issues. Yeah, I was impressed by that.
Yeah. So those were my two favorite parts, and it was good. It wasn't great, but middle of the range.
Okay, fair enough. The original season 4 episode 9, Queen Death, came in at an 8. I, Zombie season 3 episode 8, Ida Knievel, came in at 8. Supergirl, Season 2, Episode 22, Nevertheless, She Persisted, the second season finale, came in at 7.83. We all kind of gave it a little bit of a middling. Well, you gave it an 8, which is still above average, but yeah, I was a little bit disappointed with this one. But what about you, Gary? Your thoughts on this?
Yes. Yeah, I was severely disappointed. Well, I expected some of it to play out the way it played up. Rhea's general dishonesty and downright cheating during this battle surprised me. I thought it might have been a straight fight, and it turned out not to be. And we had, you know, things in our corner too. And sometimes the simple answers are the easiest. And the idea of flooding the atmosphere with lead particles, whilst, you know, something in me says that that's not healthy, I will just let it go to the wayside because that's plot. So that aside, which, you know, don't have lead anywhere to build up in the environment anyway, I like the idea that I guess it was interesting that they decided to use it as a thing to force the Daxamites off of Earth rather than have it literally poison and kill them with any exposure, which is the way it is in the comic books. As a diehard Legion fan, I was very disappointed that that Mon-El was not somehow poisoned and needed to be put into the Phantom Zone, which is where he should have been put.
Yes, I understand.
Yes. So anyway, yes, to bring full circle, and we've been promised that the ring will be interesting next season. So we'll have. I'm referring, of course, to the Legion Flight Ring in the Fortress. As a longtime Legion fan, long live the Legion. And anyway, so I was surprised by that ending, that he just sort of had to leave, and that while it wasn't discussed, I guess it was just sort of understood that Kara would not leave the Earth, or was even asked about this, whether, you know, she wanted to go somewhere else with him because she loves him so much, but she wouldn't leave her family or Clark. And so she, she wasn't going to leave the Earth at all. But I thought that might have merited a conversation on the spaceship. I would have liked to have seen something like that, where you saw her torn. So even more so that, you know, oh, you can be with me. We just can't be on Earth. And then to have her not do that. Right. We never really got that, which would have, I thought, really lent a lot more depth to not only the relationship, but to her feelings of her, the people on Earth, and why she doesn't want to just go into space, even though she would be capable of doing so. That being said, Kat again was a pleasure to have in this episode as well, and I do hope they have her revisit for a few episodes next season. If obviously I don't expect her to come back as a season regular, but it was nice, and if we. I'm trying to think, John. Has she she did actually admit to knowing that Kara's Supergirl by the end of this episode, right? Which was
she in fact admitted for all intent purposes that she's known for a long time now.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So that was not necessarily a reveal. We always had a sense, although I you know, it makes you wonder why was she on Kara so much if she knew that, and it definitely gives you food for thought. But again, the villain was weak. The fight was not honorable in any real way. Even our side really had an ace up the hole anytime they wanted to use it, regardless of whose finger was on the button. And so that was slightly disappointing. And as I said, the Mon-El ending left me a little lackluster, having him just fly away without any actual real confrontation over the ramifications of what's happening, other than I have to go. So I hope we get to see Mon-El again at some point, and we'll see what else happens in the meantime. I also like the fact that Kat called out Jimmy. I can see you right through the eyes.
Yes, that was a really good line that had me
laughing for a good few minutes. So, so it was fun. But I think it was the villain weakness and lackluster finale to the season that held my score down a little bit.
Yeah. It was a little bit lackluster, as you said. I felt like it's like, wow, you started off with a fight with Superman, so anything after that is going to feel just a bit small. Into the Badlands, Season 2, Episode 10, Wolf's Breath, Dragonfire, the second season finale, came in at a 7.5. Outcast, Season 2, Episode 8, Mercy, came in at 7.5. And finally, The Americans, Season 5, Episode 12, The World Council of Churches, came in at a 7.5. And Edmund has to say here, hard to believe this is the penultimate episode. With so little happening throughout the season, it snuck up on us without much sense of drama or tension. The beats that have been set up, Philip and Elizabeth's growing but to different extents, dissatisfaction with Moscow Station, will they go home? Where is home? The amorphous mission with the defectors, the never-ending and equally indistinct Topeka mission, haven't come together well at all. Their run of creating memorable supporting characters that really turned on them this season, as all the new ones were poor reflections of those we've lost. Gad versus the new boss, whose name never registered, young he versus... oh, God. Really? No, I'm not doing that. Edmund, no. Nina versus Stan's new recruit, Sophia. Martha and Gabriel reduced to bit parts. The Moscow sections have been interesting, but I wish they'd have expanded them to include those last two. They seem to be setting up the actual conditions in Russia to contrast with the idealized view that Elizabeth has always held of the motherland, showing how an actual American and a longtime operative react to coming home would have deepened that narrative. As it is, I'm not feeling too invested in what Philip and those trailing after him find at Popple's house, not because it's not a terrible situation that's been set up, but because we've only been told what's going on, hardly ever shown it. A strangely static season lurches to a close. Fingers crossed for a better finale to launch them towards the final season. With fewer episodes comes to greater urgency. Let's hope so. Yeah, I feel the same way as Edmund does. This season of The Americans has felt like almost a non-entity in many respects, which is surprising, considering the first four seasons were so strong and well-beloved by so many. This really feels like maybe being told they had two seasons was a drawback, because they basically wasted one of those seasons completely. This fifth season has been really disappointing. And that's unfortunately where we're going to end up this particular discussion in this episode. Next week, I'm just going to kind of give a preview. We've mentioned that, this season, or rather this week, we had 19 shows with 21 episodes. Just to give you an idea of what happens at the end of May, next week we have 11 shows. So basically cut in half. Yeah. It's a pretty big drop. So, yep. That and next week we actually have at least, I'm just going down the list, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 season finales out of those 11 shows. So, yeah, we're definitely at the close of the traditional period, and we're in that transition into the summer season. So, yeah, a little bit less to go over, but that just means we can dig in deeper on a couple of these shows. So, Gary, any last thoughts for this week?
No, I'm the, as several of the CW shows come to an end, I'm sort of ambiguous to where some of them are going to go forward. Supergirl as well as Flash, they definitely sort of left open endings, but I'm really not sure what's going to happen. So I'm trepidatious. Supergirl, as we said, has had a mixed season, and even The Flash was, this was one of their weaker seasons. While they were renewed, I'm still concerned for if they're going to be able to pick up the game, so we'll have to see.
Yep, we definitely will have to see, and we've also got some discussions coming regarding, say, Arrow, for instance, as its season will draw to a close. But that's where I'm going to leave everything as well, and so hopefully, please give your feedback on your agreement or disagreement, as, yes, we have some shows that are definitely very high profile right now, one of them obviously being Twin Peaks. So please give your opinions either here or on my reviews over at the VOG Network site. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG Network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.